requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group's Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, that's me, and I attended a group conscience meeting. So I did that stuff because I was desperate to stay sober, and you guys told me that part of staying sober is doing service, which is part of this program, which was outlined to me through the first 160 pages of that big blue book with a sponsor who worked those steps with a sponsor. And by the grace of God, I made it here, and I'm standing in front of you because I had a really, really bad drinking problem. Bad for me, maybe not bad for you, maybe worse than yours, but it was bad enough that I couldn't stop, and I needed a way out, and I ran out of solutions. So what else? I am going to announce or introduce our speaker. He is somebody that I really, really respect, and I asked him to speak because he speaks from the heart, and he, for whatever reason, speaks in a language that I really understand. He speaks a good AA message, and I'm not going to build him up or anything because he's just a human being like me. But he's a really nice guy, and his name is... Oh, my God.
Evan!
Evan! Hi. This is really embarrassing. I'm nervous, okay? I'm nervous. I know.
Hey guys, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, Evan.
My name is Evan R., and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Matt, thank you so much for making a mistake, and now I'm not quite as nervous. I appreciate that. And then I just dropped my phone. Hi, Renee. Yeah, thank you so much for asking me to speak, and welcome to the newcomers and those that are coming back. I'm very loud, so I guess you just adjusted that. Thank you. It's the Cuban in me. I'm half Cuban. I know I have my cell phone in hand, but that's only because there's a couple things that I know I will absolutely forget tonight if I don't look at this every now and then. But I did my third set prayer before speaking, and God is absolutely in control of what comes out of my mouth. So that being said, there's some great people here tonight, and thank you all so much for coming out, and I'm just honored that I get to be up here. This is my third time speaking at Central, I actually spoke here a year ago, it would be a year and about 2 weeks ago, and those of you that know me know that I was going through something at that time, which I have 99% recovered from, and we'll get to that in my story. So, that being said, I'll start at the top. I'll try to tell you guys what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I only have about 50 minutes to do that, and I had 22 years of craziness, and then about 8 years of sobriety after that, also a lot of which was crazy. So my sobriety date is March 3rd, 2006. That's by the grace of God, and because I worked the 12 steps that Matt was talking about, and I had great sponsors and great friends and family that loved me and cared about me, and a God that saw fit to save me so that I could help others. I do speak from my heart. I am pretty emotional. I will try to get through this without crying, but no promises. I'll also try to get through it without cussing, also no promises, and I'll try to get through it without mentioning things other than alcohol, again, no promises. So if you're here tonight and you're new, the first thing I want to point out to you is this right here. And what it says is the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. That's very important. It was very important for me to know coming in because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't know what a drug addict was. I didn't know what an ANDA was or NA or AA or SLAA or OA or any of those. All I knew is that I could not stop drinking. In fact, I had never even heard of AA. But then years later, after I got sober, I remembered that somebody took me to an AA meeting when I was 15, and I was blackout drunk and didn't remember it. That man is still sober today, and we're good friends. So we'll start at the top. I come from a family in Miami. I was born and raised, and any Miami people here tonight? Awesome. I am not alone. Miami was a pretty crazy place to grow up. I don't know if any of you have ever... Who's partied in Miami, at least? All right, sorry. So then, as you know, Miami's a pretty wild place, and I was exposed to quite a bit at an early age. But before we get there, I'll tell you a little bit about my background. My mother, my father, and now my stepmother and stepfather, and also identical twin, are all lawyers. Okay? I know how to argue, I know how to lie, I know how to manipulate, I know how to cheat, I know how to work you over and get you to do what I want or think that I do, and I really don't at the end of the day. I just thought that I did. But I come from a very good family. I come from a very good family. My family loved me very much. I never wanted anything. I never went hungry. I never went homeless until I started drinking. And everything was great on the outside. We come from a very high power family in Miami. My mother is a political figure down there, and I won't break her anonymity. But from a very young age, it was important to have the outside look good, the show. Get you guys to like me, and if you liked me, I could like me. And that was a pattern I learned very young. As I said, I am a twin brother. And I don't know if you guys know, I know my friend Megan over here can probably identify that you're set at a competition at a very young age. Who's taller? Who's cuter? Who's thinner? Who's faster? Who's stronger? Who's smarter? Who gets this and what? And that built another pattern into my life. Again, I'm not the victim of anything. This is just to give you guys some background. So I remember, I'll just fast forward, I guess, to my first point in which I knew my life was going to be different. When I was 11 years old, I was playing a game with my brother. And this is very hard for me to talk about early on in recovery because I demonize myself for it and I judge myself a lot for it. But I've since forgiven myself and realized that I was just a kid. And kids do stupid shit. And this particular stupid thing that I did was to invent a game in which my brother and I would fight in the middle of the street at night. And a car coming by would see us fighting, and one of us would take off, and the other would pretend to be injured. And then we would hustle that person for money. And we would say, hey, I need to get to the hospital. I'm beaten up. Give me $20. And it worked a lot. And so at that young age, I learned, and I don't know why we did it. We had plenty of money. We had plenty of, we had everything we ever wanted. I don't know. Maybe I was bored. I don't know. People say they were born an alcoholic. I don't think I was born an alcoholic, but I was certainly born with a disposition to be an alcoholic. And I learned how to do things at a very young age, and I think that that fueled my alcoholism. But anyways, on one night, the game didn't work. The car didn't see me. And rather than stopping and asking if I was okay, the car proceeded to hit me. And I was 11 years old at the time. It shattered 6 bones in my pelvis, about 7 in my tailbone. And if Dennis is here, he's heard me speak a number of times. He can tell you if my math is wrong on that, and he'll probably call me on it later. So, but anyways, it landed me in the hospital. And I remember being in the hospital bed, and they had this thing at the time, it's an outside thing, but it rhymes with schmorphine, and I say that all the time. And they gave me the schmorphine drip, and anytime I wanted, I could push this button, and it would inject this liquid into my body that would make me feel good. And I remember that first pinch that it gave me, that first little outside, oh my God, there's a way to escape reality. But anyways, fast forward, I get out of the hospital, and now I'm in the wheelchair, and again, me and my twin brother, he's the standing one, the cute one with the mushroom haircut, and I'm the one in the wheelchair with the missing teeth and the plastic surgery face and all the 9 yards. So that definitely did something to my self-esteem and my ego and my need for acceptance and approval. And that's when I started using. That's when I started finding ways to escape. Fast forward, when we were 14, our parents sent us to Spain to learn how to speak Spanish. And guys, just buy Rosetta Stone for your kids, okay? You don't need to send them to a country where there's no drinking age and they can stay out as late as they want and all they need is to be able to see the bar to order a drink, because that's what we did. And I remember my first drink. It was a bottle of Spanish whiskey. We were at a camp, and we snuck out in the middle of the night, and we bought this piss-colored bottle of just probably the grossest whiskey that's ever been created on God's earth. And I remember we were sitting on the roof, and I remember taking this big gulp, because I'm an all-or-nothing kind of guy. And, dude, like a lot of people say that, either, you know, I don't know, people have different experiences. Mine was I got drunk. Like, I got really, really drunk, and I loved it. I fucking loved it. I had arrived. I was like, and for the first time in my life, I could go, ah, I got that great, ah, kind of like the one I got 20 minutes ago when I was in the bathroom praying for God to just... and that's been my experience today, is that I get today through this program what I used to get through the bottle. And what I get through this program today is long-lasting. It's not instantaneous, but it certainly doesn't go away as quickly as alcohol. And it's also infinite, which is cool. But anyways, so now I've discovered whiskey, and I'm with a bunch of 18-year-old, 19-year-old Spanish kids that know how to roll things other than alcohol, and smoke things other than alcohol, and snort things other than alcohol. And I did a lot of things other than alcohol, but alcohol was definitely my love. Fast forward, we come back from Spain, and now we're in high school. Is that too much? Thank you. Yeah. Sorry, guys. Appreciate that. It's funny, I'm a musician. I'm in front of microphones all the time. You think I know how to use them better. But anyways, we come back, and now we're in high school, and I'm no longer in a wheelchair. And I went through a growth spurt because of the accident, so it set my testosterone and all things in motion a lot earlier. And now all of a sudden I was the taller twin and the cuter twin, and I was getting the attention, and I loved it. I knew what that felt like, and I got that desire. I went to a school in Key Biscayne called Mass Academy. It was a magnet school. And I, to this day, have no idea how I got in. I think that it says in the book that alcoholics are intelligent people. And I think that we're able to do a lot without really trying, for the most part. And that's what I did. I got away. I just got away with it. I just kind of like did enough to get by. So high school, right around the age of 16, my father and mother got a divorce. And that was another big way for me to act out, and another excuse, another reason to drown myself in drugs and alcohol. And as I said earlier, my mother's a political figure, so this was actually front page news in the newspaper. And here I am, 16-year-old man, boy, whatever I was at the time, and I show up to school, and there's my teachers and the principal and everyone else reading this, and my last name is plastered on the front page. And again, that did something to me. That did something to my ego, and it was another reason. I was the victim. Victim, 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 victim. My whole life, victim, victim, victim. And I remember that year after the divorce, my father was the disciplinarian. My mother is the, God bless her heart, just loves too much, the enabler. And when he was gone, the cats away, the mice will play, my brother and I just went nuts. And parties constantly around the clock. She also was using, so she would go upstairs and do her thing, and then we had the whole house to ourselves, and it was down the street from school, so there you go, a bunch of 16-year-olds with no supervision and access to a giant liquor cabinet. So we did that for a while. And, there's a lot of things, people say that, I don't know, people say different things, but there was good times for me in the drinking. I didn't just go straight from, from nothing to horrible. There was good times. But like in our literature it says, is like, we can't recapture that. I think it was Jorge or someone else the other week that was like, God gave me a certain amount of liquor that I was allowed to drink in my lifetime. And that was for the whole lifetime. And I used all of it from the age of 14 to 22. So that's it. I have abused my brain and my body to the point where I have developed an allergy in which I can no longer safely drink alcohol. It's really that simple. Anyways, fast forward. I didn't graduate that high school. I got expelled from that high school because there was a Christmas break one year where my brother and a bunch of other my friends, I actually had the master keys to the school, and I decided it would be a good idea to break in and not like steal anything, just mess with everybody, like pranks left and right. Like we like stacked the chairs and put them in the wrong room, and like just the stuff that you do when you're on a lot of stuff other than alcohol, that like makes sense to you at the time. But when I was coming out of the school, of course, there was Miami-Dade police and Key Biscayne police, and all these cops were there, and they were ready to arrest me. And that was my first felony arrest. And again, you'd think this would slow you down or stop you. These were just badges of honor for me. When you're 17 and you got a felony and you're on the news, you're a badass. It's just kind of the way it is. And because who my mother was, it was, again, all over the news. Channel 7, Channel 10, Channel 4. And so not only had I gotten expelled, now they sent me to a public school. My magnet school was 550 kids. My public school was 3,500 kids. I'm the new guy with the blowout and the visor and the mother who's on television, and I'm the felon that's now at the school. And that did a lot for my ego, a lot. And it turned me into this legend in my own mind mentality where I was invincible. I could do whatever I wanted and get away with it. And I did for a long time. From junior year, pretty much through college, arrest after arrest after arrest, and I always got away with it. I always got off somehow. A good lawyer, a call from my mom, call to the judge, whatever. And you know, it just kept feeding this insanity. That's all. That's the only word for it, is just insanity. You know, I discovered some harder substances other than the ones I'd been doing, and I got pretty into those. But again, alcohol was always the one. It was always the true love. So somehow, I don't know, I graduated high school. I got into Florida State University. All right, any Noles out there? And at the time, I see you, at the time, it was the number 4 party school, you know, ranked by Playboy or Maxim or whoever in the nation. And my parents, who again loved me and supported me and wanted the best for me, paid for my rent for an entire year. Just said, here's your apartment, go to school, good luck. And I flunked out like in the first month. It was ridiculous. I mean, I literally just like didn't go to class. I had my new apartment, all the alcohol and all the other substances I could want, and I just went crazy. And here I again, all my friends in Miami moved up there, and it just, again, fed to this invincibility. You know, rushed a frat here, rushed a frat there, didn't really do much other than drink. Just drink, man. Then on my 19th birthday, I threw this party to, like, end all parties. And it was awesome. But it in my mind, it was awesome. In reality, it was not. And I got arrested again, this for my second felony. I won't get into the details of that, but basically my parents are like, okay, you got to come home. Like, that's it. We're cutting you off. Come home. So I come home, and again, they don't know what to do with me. You know, they have no clue how bad my alcoholism is. They can tell a little bit, but they haven't really gotten a glimpse into it yet. And my dad, who is remarried at this time, is moving to Vermont. And before he moves to Vermont, he's like, all right, I got to take care of my son. I got to do something. Evan, I happen to have this condo in West Palm Beach. Do you want to go live there? Gave me a condo. Give a 19-year-old kid with full-blown alcoholism a condo in West Palm Beach and see what happens, man. And that's what I did. You know what I mean? And I, you know, I used every single day. Every single day. I bartended on Clematis, and my only job was to deal with alcohol. There was days, even weeks, I'd go without seeing the sun. And this was normal. And I don't know about you guys, but throughout my alcoholic career, I would find people that were doing the same thing so I could normalize what I was doing. Because if you weren't using like me, I didn't want to hang out with you. You were weak. I had to find somebody that could hang. You know what I mean? And that's what I did. And I surrounded myself with the drug addicts and the alcoholics and the people that wanted to use me for my condo and all the other great stuff that came along with that. So after about a year living there, my dad, who had moved to Vermont, came back down and came to visit me. And I'm sure some of you guys did this. We used to keep bottles like trophies, you know what I mean? Like how many you drank. And I'm not even exaggerating. Literally, I built shelves, and it was just the entire circumference of my apartment, the kitchen, the bedroom, the bathroom, everything. And it was like trophies for me. And my dad was like, you know, what the – you know what I mean? I got to get you out of here. So sold the condo, got me out of there. I'll get sober here in a little bit, I promise.
Sure.
Everybody makes fun of me because of my giant water bottle, but it used to be something else. At least it's water today, you know? I moved back to Miami. And again, you know, and by this time I think I've been to like 3 colleges. I went to like FSU and Palm Beach Community College, you know, just flunking out. And I'm staying with my mom, and I'll just fast forward to my last drunk. I'm staying at her house. She moved. She's living in Coconut Grove now. And again, same thing. I live in the bottom floor. She lives on the top floor. I get to do whatever I want. Parties all the time. I mean, just, you know, gets sick of talking about it after a while. And I remember my last drunk. It was a Tuesday night, and I was staying at my buddy Bell's house, and we had done copious amounts of things, including and also other than alcohol. And I woke up in the middle of the night, like fully dressed. I was like sleeping on his couch. And I walked like 3.5 miles. By the way, I was a full-on blackout drinker, in case you guys didn't realize that from my story yet. I would fight everything, not just people, but like anything. I got arrested in Tallahassee for like kicking a wall down for no reason. There was another night where I have this giant scar on my leg to show, where I got in a fight with a house, and I didn't like the house. I thought the house was like arrogant, and I was like, "Who do you think you are?" And it's ridiculous. And there was this glass plate, and I remember putting my foot through the glass and like falling into it. And a cop came, and that cop actually saved my life because he ripped his sleeve off and built a tourniquet around my leg. And my buddy was there, and I don't remember any of this, but he told me I was, like, cussing out the cop the whole time. I'm like, "You're a bleep, 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 and bleep," you know, just ridiculous. And this guy's, like, saving my life. I don't remember any of it. And then apparently in the hospital, as the doctor is, like, stitching my leg, same thing. I'm like, "You're a bleep, bleep doctor. I don't need this, you know, F you. Don't you know who I think I am?" All this craziness. And you'd think that'd be enough to stop. You think that when I woke up the next day and my foot was in this suspension bridge with 56 stitches, that I would say, "Maybe I have a drinking problem." But I didn't. I let it feed my ego, and I was that guy at the party on crutches. Like, "What a badass, man. You got 56 stitches and you're still partying. All right." You know what I mean? Just craziness. So anyways, back to the Tuesday. So I woke up, and it was like 6 a.m., and I'm in this blackout, and I walk like 3.5 miles to this gas station. And the other thing I forgot to mention is that I'm kind of a klepto. When, you know, before I got sober, I would steal everything. Didn't matter. Not even valuable stuff, like orange safety cones and like I would like a hanging plant. I like just ridiculous things that served no purpose or value in my life. I would steal like golf carts and then like return them the next day. Just craziness. And so I went to this gas station and I saw this red minivan. And the ironic thing today is that, like, I watch the video of this all the time. Well, I used to before we took it down. And there was, like, a BMW to the left and, like, a Jaguar to the right of this red minivan. Like, a 97 beat-up, like, minivan. But I wanted to steal the minivan. I don't know what. Like, why didn't I want, like, the Beamer or, like, the Jaguar? I just wanted the minivan. So, So I opened the door, and the reason it was unlocked, and this is like the most ironic thing, and I don't believe in irony, I think everything happens for a reason. The door is unlocked, and the hood is up. And those of you that have heard me speak know this story. And the hood's up, and the door's open. So I get into the car, I open the door, and the keys are in it. And this is the middle of the, you know, this is 6:30 in the morning, and I'm like trying to like start the car for like 20 minutes. I'm like, "It's not working, it's not working, it's not working." Well, the reason it wasn't working is because the guy that owned the gas station, that was his van, and he happened to be under the hood of the van fixing the starter. He was literally 4 feet away under the hood, and I'm there for like 10 minutes, and he's like, "What's going on?" He comes around the side, and he's like, "Dude, what are you doing?" And apparently I was just like, "I got it. I got it. I'm good. You were good to go." And he's like, "What are you doing?" So, I mean, you know, you might be an alcoholic if. And so he goes inside. He can tell I'm clearly not in my right state of mind. And he goes and he calls the cops. And it's funny. His name was Angel. And you guys could think that's corny or cheese, whatever. I think that's kind of cool. You know, Angel ended up saving my life. That was my last drink. You know, I think that's kind of cool. So anyways, the cops get there, they arrest me, I'm trying to like break out of my handcuffs, I'm like banging my head on the back wall, I'm doing all this crazy stuff, and I'm like glimpses of like reality are starting to pop into, you know, I was like 3 days of a blackout, but I remember waking up and I'm in a hospital and then I pass back out, and then I remember waking up and I'm on this black leather couch, I have no idea what day it is, what time it is, where the hell, what city I'm in, nothing, and apparently I was in my lawyer's office. And my lawyer had, like, bailed me out of jail. And I get on the phone, and I first person I call is him, and I'm like, dude, what's going on? He's like, look, just go somewhere and turn on the television. I'm like, okay. So I find out where I'm at. I walk down the street, and my girlfriend at the time is living there. And I didn't get into my sex relations, but I was just as much of a prick with those as I was with the other stuff that I did. I abused a lot of trust from women. But anyways, and so I go to my girlfriend at the time's house, and I turn on the television, and sure enough, on Channel 7 News, there I am. And I'm in a jail cell, and I look like, I don't know if you guys have ever played Mortal Kombat, but like a fatality, where you're just like waiting to die. And I look like a zombie. And like the camera, apparently there's a camera in the jail cell. I'm like flicking off the camera. I'm spitting. I don't remember any of it, dude. None of it. And what's crazy is like, you know, that was one of the biggest gifts that I was ever given, because for the first time in my life, I like saw the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. And it scared the shit out of me. And even worse was the knowledge that my mother, my father, my grandmother, my cousins, my aunts, my uncles, all these people that gave me everything were watching that. You know? Fuck, dude. Selfish and self-centered to the extreme. To the extreme. I didn't give a shit. And that was where I did my 1-2-3 step without even knowing what that was. It chokes me up. Excuse me. So I got on my knees at my girlfriend's house, and I was like, whatever you are, God, because, you know, I'd given up on God the moment I got hit by that car when I was 11, and then my parents and everything else. I blamed him for everything. But I was like, if you're real and you exist, this shit has to stop. Enough. Enough is enough is enough. And I got on the phone, I called my lawyer, and I said, I'll do whatever it takes. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do. And he goes, well, the judge saw the video. The judge could clearly tell you were beyond belligerent. We're going to give you a chance. We're going to send you to a treatment center. We're going to see what happens. So I pass out again. Next thing I know, I wake up, and I'm in this van, and I'm on a bumpy road going into the middle of Ocklawaha Forest to the refuge. And I don't know if anyone here has been to the refuge, but that place to me is the most sacred place on earth. Because for the first time in my life, I was given a chance to see what was going on with me. You know, when you're spinning a million miles an hour, it's really hard to see outside the tornado. When you're in the middle of it, it's really hard to be objective and be like, oh shit, that's happening. But this was the first time I was able to just kind of pause for a second, turn off the cell phone, get rid of the, this is going to age me, but the MySpace, get rid of the drug dealers and the enablers and everything else in my life, and really just take a second and say, what's going on here? But sure enough, the ego is still there, and I was just an ass for the first, like, month. I was just an ass. And, you know, I did everything they said not to do. It's funny, I still have it to this day. They said, make a list. We want you to make a list of all the things you want to accomplish while you're here. Number one, get a tan. Number two, ride a horse. Number three, hook up with a girl. I put that on the list. Who does that? But you know, slowly but surely, I couldn't ignore it anymore. And sitting in meeting after meeting and counselor after counselor and day after day, it took about 30 days for my head to finally pop out of my ass. And I couldn't look at myself in the mirror anymore. I just couldn't do it. And we did this thing, and I'll try to fast forward here, called breathwork. And I used to not tell this story because people would come up to me and be like, yo, you're kind of crazy. You probably not tell that story. But it's what got me sober. It was my white light experience. And it's very sacred to me. And not everyone gets a white light experience, but I did. But that's not enough to keep you sober. You have to continue and work the steps and have the educational variety spiritual experience. But we did this thing called breath work where we're all sitting in this circle. And it's a Native American practice. And through this practice, you're able to kind of have a vision. And again, I was still atheist at the time. I hated God. I had nothing, you know, nothing other than me was in charge of the universe. But I remember having this profound out-of-body experience. And I'll just give you the quick elevator version of it. I was in flames. I was in hell. and I could feel these claws like tearing at my flesh. And I remember turning into a phoenix. And I remember an angel coming and pulling me. And I also remember a girl being in the flames as well and me pulling her. And together, the three of us, we got out. And again, you know, when it was over and we came out of it, again, my rationalization and justification tried to rule it off. Like, it was just, you know, something that it was a fluke. But we all journaled. Every single one of us journaled about this experience that we had. And we're on the bench smoking cigarettes. I don't know if you guys have ever been to treatment, but you know, like, cigarettes is the thing to do. There's nothing else to do in a treatment center but, like, reading cigarettes. And this was the moment where the armor was chinked, where there was a God. The girl that was to my left, we all switched our journals. We said, hey, let me read yours. Okay, let me read yours. The girl that was to my left wrote, I was a girl in hell, and I was burning in flames, and a phoenix came and pulled me out. And the phoenix was being pulled by an angel. Okay? Then the girl to my right gave me her journal. She said, I was an angel, and I saw a phoenix holding on to a girl in hell. And I pulled him out. So, me too. Every time I say it. My God is very real and large and in charge. And to this day, the only possible reason that I know that happened is so that I could be standing here and helping, not all of you, but maybe one guy or one girl. So, anyways, excuse me. Fast forward, I get out of the treatment center, and they say, you're not going back to Miami, ever. Don't ever go back to Miami. Here's your discharge plan. Why don't you go to Orlando? I'm a musician, and I'm an actor. And I heard about Full Sail University, and I said, okay, let's give it a shot. So I came to Orlando, and I've been here for 8 years. And let me tell you, man, these 8 years have been, you know, there's a story with Jeff in the book where he's like, I wouldn't trade my worst day sober for my best day drinking. And, like, I was that arrogant guy in the meeting that was like, dude, you didn't do the drugs I did, because there was, like, a moment where it was awesome. But what they're saying is, is you have to look at the big picture. And I have never once in 8 years found that to not be true. Not once. So what it's like now, I got about 15 minutes. I was 22 years old when I got sober. And I do only have one white chip. And the reason that I say that is not because it's better or worse. It's not a competition. It's not, my recovery is in no way better or worse than anyone else's. The reason I say it is because when I was 22, I heard someone else say it, and it gave me the hope that I could also do that. So that's the only reason I share that at a meeting, that if you are ready, and you're done, and you're willing, and you're honest, and you can open your mind up just a little bit, you too can get and stay sober no matter what. So I went back to school, and I got an AA degree, and I got all A's. And then I was like, all right, this is cool. Let me do it again. I got an AS degree, and I got all A's. I was like, all right, this is cool. So then I applied to UCF, and I got in. I had been to 6 universities before this time. And, you know, it talks about in the book, again, that we alcoholics are perfectionists, and we strive for perfection, and when we don't, we settle for the bottle and oblivion. And that's what I had been doing my whole life, is I've been settling. I've been settling and saying, if I can't be the best, I'm going to be the worst. If I can't have the most, I'm going to have the least. And I'm either going to be better than you, or I'm going to be worse than you. And it's been my experience that today, I live somewhere in the middle, and that we all have these incredible gifts that we can offer and give. And it doesn't mean one is better than the other, but it does mean that it's my responsibility to find out what those are. Because if I don't live this life in my second chance to the fullest, it's like a big middle finger to my higher power. Saying, thanks for the gift, I'm going to go be a dick. I don't want to do that. Excuse my language. So anyways, I told you I was going to forget a whole bunch of stuff, so I need to look at least at this so I can see what I'm doing here. Okay. Fast forward after going to UCF, like I said, I'm a musician, and I started a band called The Reprieve, and I actually borrowed The Reprieve from our program. Reprieve is a temporary relief of discomfort. And we did a lot of great stuff, and I had a lot of amazing experiences. And, you know, page 100 and 101, I wholeheartedly believe that we can go anywhere and do anything that normal men can do, and women. And that if we're spiritually fit, we the world is our oyster. We can have it all, provided that for me, that I always give the glory and I give the credit to my higher power. There was a humility plaque on that wall for a while. I'm not sure where it went. But I wholeheartedly believe in that statement, is that to be humble doesn't mean to be less than. I used to think that. I used to think that to be humble, I have to be like kind of like coy and shy. And that's not what it's saying. What it's saying is it's a desire to live rightly under God and under God's grace and to seek and do His will. I'm up here, and if you think God is scary, right, and it's a scary concept, let me assure you that I was an atheist and an agnostic, and I wanted nothing to do with God. And that's why this program is so awesome, because right here, the only thing that they have underlined in all 200 words of these 12 steps is as we understand Him. You know, when Bill and Bob made this thing, they were very, very careful to say that. Because especially when Bob was getting a little hardcore in it, Bill was like, hey man, let's not make this too religious. You know? Because before AA, there was the Washingtonians, and there was hundreds and thousands of them. And they would get up on the soapbox and preach this and preach that, and it didn't work. Most of them got drunk and died. You know, AA is the first place where they were like, "Hey, we don't care what you believe, just as long as it's not just you. Make the group your higher power." You know, everybody that comes in here has an experience and has something that they can tell. I heard an expression one time: "There's a wrench for every nut in AA," and I find that to be true. And the more that I keep coming back, I find that I'm not alone. And that although on the outside we may be very different, on the inside we know what it's like to be fearful, and we know what it's like to be desperate. And we have a common problem with a common solution. And that solution is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would encourage you, if you're new or just coming back, go outside of your comfort zone a little bit. Do something that you don't want to do. Because every time I've done that, and every time I've chosen courage versus fear, I've been rewarded for it. Tonight, I did not want to be here. I didn't want to do this at all. I was coming up with excuses last night, texting Matt. I was like, hey man, I'm in Miami, I may not be able to make it. You know, bullshit. I absolutely can make it, and I have to make it, because this is what keeps me sober today. So real quick, I'll just go through the steps and how they worked for me and how I applied them in my life. Obviously, step one, you know, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol way before I ever got sober, but it took getting sober to see the second half, which is that my life had become unmanageable. Okay, it took me stopping using for a couple of 24 hours to see, oh my God, I've been a total, you know what, okay? So with that desperation that you guys heard in my story, that opened the door. That was enough that I was willing, you know. It says the how of AA is honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And it says that that's not born of bravado. I didn't wake up one day and I was like, man, I'm going to be sober. This is great. I woke up one day and I was like, I don't want to die. What do you got for me? And this is what they gave to me. Step two, can we believe in a power greater than ourselves to restore us to sanity? The first thing I had to be convinced of is that I was insane. And it's not hard, listening to my story, to see that I was clearly insane. And if you can take an objective look at what you've done and what you've been through, maybe you too can say, all right, you know, you get hit by one car, you get hit by two cars, you get hit by three cars, maybe I should stop jaywalking, like they say in the book, you know. I love the peanut allergy thing. If someone's allergic to peanuts, and they go out one night with their buddies, and they drink a whole bag of peanuts, and they have a horrible reaction, and they break out in hives, and it ruins their life, and it ruins their family, and it ruins their friendships, and they find themselves homeless, and it takes away everything, they don't go out the next weekend and eat more peanuts. They just don't do it. We have that mental twist, and we have that insanity that says, this time it's going to be different. This time I can safely eat the peanuts, right? That's insane. So once I'm convinced that I need to be, that I can be restored to sanity, I have to make that decision. Now, for me, that was very easy, because I just didn't want to drink again. And I've been told, and I wholeheartedly agree with this, that a step three is just deciding to do the rest of the steps. And the second I put my first name down on step four, that I've started my fourth step. It doesn't mean that I have to understand God. I still don't understand God. It says in our literature that, you know, none of us will ever fully comprehend or know that power which is God. And I wholeheartedly believe that. Because if God is infinite and I can understand him, clearly he's not infinite, right? I reached the end. So step three. Step four. I balked at step four for so long, guys. And the best analogy I ever heard for this was like, if I own a 7-Eleven and the milk is going bad and the eggs are going bad and everything is going bad, it'll do my business good to take an inventory of that and maybe replace some of the stuff on the shelves. You know what I mean? But because of fear and pride, we balk at that. We balk at that and we say, oh no, I don't want to look at that. But all it's doing is accumulating more spoiled milk. So step five. I got to do my fifth step in treatment. And it's been incredible because I've seen a fifth step and I've done a fifth step. And let me tell you, like, doing a fifth step is incredible, but listening to one, oh my God. If you can stay sober long enough to hear somebody else's fifth step, it's unbelievable. It's one of the most humbling experiences I've ever encountered in my life. It's there's no way to describe it. Six and seven are the two, like, steps, in my opinion, that kind of get, like, overlooked or whatever. And for me, they're very important, especially in the 12 and 12, because it talks about how we're not bad because we have instincts, right? God made me that way. I want money. I want clothing. I want women. I want power. I want security. I want all these things that I want. And it's not the want of those that's bad. It's wanting more than my fair share. And it's when it drives me blindly, or I start hurting others, or lying, or cheating, or manipulating to get those things. But I don't need to feel guilty about the fact that I want a nice car or a nice house. Okay? So 6 and 7 was very important to me because I always felt shame about those things. I always felt wrong, and that the God of my understanding was going to judge me and send me to this place where I was going to burn forever. And that's not my experience. Step 7, I say almost every day. I forgot to mention. When I got sober, they told me to say the third step every single day, and I can honestly say that in 8 years, I've never missed a single day without saying that prayer. Probably out of superstition at this point. I don't know, but I'm not going to test it. I say it every single day, and I haven't had a drink in 8 years, so I don't want to see if I don't want to break that. 8 and 9. Oh my God, I got a real quick story to tell you about 8 and 9. So, after all the damage I put my family through, right, I never, ever, ever, ever thought that I would have a relationship with them. I talked to my twin brother a couple hours ago. My dad and I, we talk almost every day. My mom calls me almost every night. She asked me for spiritual advice now. I was the guy that, like, wasn't allowed on her property. I used to, like, break into her house and steal from her, and now she trusts me. I'm a son. I'm a brother. I'm a man in her eyes today. I'm trustworthy. And those direct amends, that's how I live. How you doing, Jay? That's how I live my life today, okay, is by making a living amends. All the stuff that I put my parents through, there is no way by saying I'm sorry that it's going to make it up. No way in hell. I have to live that amends. I have to show up when I say I'm going to show up, and I have to be a brother and a son, and I have to do the things that I say I'm going to do. This is a say-do program, you know? But again, it's progress, not perfection. I mess up all the time. I do stupid shit all the time. I take my will back all the time. And I pay the consequences for it. But the one thing that I've never done is change my mind on whether or not I'm powerless over alcohol. And it says that in our literature, that that's the only step we need to work 100%. And if you're thoroughly convinced of that, and you don't have any lurking reservations or notions that you can somehow drink like a normal person, you too can stay sober. Direct amends. I went home one Christmas, the Christmas after I got sober, and I remember we say grace in my family, and like 50 people were Cuban. Remember, like I told you, and British, so there's a lot of us. And we said grace, and I raised my hand, and I made a group amends, a mass amends, at the suggestion of my sponsor, because it was almost too many to make direct amends to. And I said that, you know, I admitted what I had done, and I asked if there's anything I can do to make it up to you. And I was taught that's what an amends is. It's not saying I'm sorry. It's saying, how can I fix this? If my fence is broken and I mend the fence, I fix the fence. And after I said that, one by one, people kind of came up to me. They're like, hey, man, welcome back. welcome back to the family, dude. And I can't tell you what that was like for me. It was unbelievable. So 10, 11, 12, those are the steps I live in today. 10 is taking inventory. I don't write it out every night. I should. But I certainly do it every night. And I look for the good and the bad. I think we have a tendency in AA to kind of make self-deprecation something that's to be sought after. And I disagree with that. I think that self-love is what's important, and learning how to honor the God within me so that I can then honor the God within you. And it's by taking account of the good and the bad that I'm able to humbly walk under my God's grace. Step 11, I have studied Buddhism, Taoism, Christianity, Taoism, Rastafarianism, you name it, Confucianism. I've gone to yogas and sweat lodges and retreats. And at the end of the day, I have to accept that I will never fully understand or comprehend that power which is God. And I try to keep it as simple as I can today. I try not to have any rites. I live and let live. If you believe in this one or that one or any of the 68,000 world religions that are there, I'm not going to try to change your mind. Please don't try to change mine. Okay? It's live and let live in this program. And I hope that I never discover what God actually 100% is, because again, then I'd be limiting him or her or it, she, them, they. Right? And then having had a spiritual awakening, I for sure know, beyond a reason of a doubt, that I'm not the same man that I was. I've had a psychic change, and I no longer react to life the way that I used to. I pause when agitated today. And those promises that were read at the beginning of the meeting have absolutely come true for me. I don't have as much fear. But I have to keep coming back here, because what happens is my built-in forgetter kicks in, and I think I'm cured, or I think that I no longer need to do the things that I've done that have worked for 8 years. And that's why the fellowship is so important. Alcoholics Anonymous is so important, that no matter what else, I can come here, and if I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm crying, a year ago, my face is freaking paralyzed. I can come in here, and you guys will love me in spite of it. Chokes me up. I could live 10 lifetimes and never pay back what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. Couldn't do it. There's probably a lot that I wanted to say, but I guess God didn't want me to say any of that. I think that I'll end on this. There's a quote in the book that says, and I lost it. I'll paraphrase. Just to the extent as we do what we think he would have us do and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. 1 year ago, almost to date, I woke up with something called Bell's palsy. It was one of the most traumatic things that's ever happened to me, and I didn't have to drink. This program doesn't promise daisies and roses, but what it does promise is that we can get through whatever we're going through with serenity, that we don't have to drink. Man, it's unbelievable. And, if you're new or you're coming back, just keep coming. Don't leave before the miracle happens, and the miracles usually happen right after this meeting and that parking lot over there where they tell you not to smoke or anything. That's where the miracles usually happen for me. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, everybody that's here tonight. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, and God bless you all.